Lecture 4, Indo-European Vedic Culture.
Today, men and women legally identified as Hindu total about 1 billion people, 1/7 of all humanity. But Hinduism contains a broad range of religious traditions with a wide variety of beliefs and practices that developed and changed over many centuries, as we'll see. Hindus also include people of many different biological ancestries. Indeed, the label Hindu itself was a name historically used by outsiders to describe Indians and their religion. Only in the past 2 centuries have people living in India used that term Hindu for themselves. In order to understand the origins of what has become eventually known as Hinduism, we should go back to its ancient foundations. Then, as one of our major themes in these lectures as a whole, we'll follow the fascinating and complex historical development of both the religion and also of the communities of diverse people now collectively known as Hindus. Already, we've explored the complex physical environment of the Indian subcontinent with its defining mountain ranges and major rivers, the ecological macro-regions and micro-regions created by these geological features provided settings in which various Indian cultures and communities lived and interacted. These led to the great diversity in Indian cultures and communities at the local and regional levels. We've also already considered the earliest communities that immigrated and settled in India prior to the arrival of the Vedic people around 1500 BCE. In broad terms, there were 2 groups. In India's still extensive forests, there were people who followed a shifting or Swidden way of life, known as the Advasi. Second, there were people who had created the remarkable urban-based literate civilization that emerged along the lower Indus River. After 700 years, the men and women of this civilization dispersed across India. These were 2 of the 3 main sources for ancient Indian society, with the Vedic people as the 3rd. Now we'll focus on the people of the Vedas, a body of sacred texts whose name means that which was known. People have been memorizing and reciting these texts virtually unchanged for 3,000 years. Every day, Vedic hymns are still chanted at weddings, funerals, and other Hindu rituals. This is the longest continuously used body of sacred texts in human history. Hence, for historians, the Vedas are a unique and amazingly well-preserved source for early human knowledge. Using the Vedas and other sources, we'll try to reconstruct the history of the clans that collectively identified themselves with the Vedas. Through interactions with each other and with the other 2 sources for ancient Indian cultures, these people evolved a model for society that spread unevenly across the subcontinent. Looking closely at the Vedic texts themselves, we should also keep in mind that they are still sacred for many believing Hindus today. As such, the Vedas as a whole are considered by many Hindu communities to be uncreated truth, the entire universe in the form of sound. In this emic model, ancient sages known as rishi were so in harmony with the cosmos that they could hear this universal knowledge. These rishis then spoke the Vedic hymns so that other humans could also hear the sounds. Therefore, the collection of texts that compose the Vedas holds status as shruti, knowledge from hearing. Hence, it is the sound of the Vedas being recited that is significant and powerful, not necessarily the literal meaning of its words. In fact, since all languages shift over the centuries, at present we can only speculate about what many Vedic words meant originally. For centuries, the Vedas remained an oral tradition. Because of this sacredness, these sounds were preserved precisely, with every syllable intact. More than 100 generations of students, down to the present day, have devoted themselves to memorizing, internalizing, even a part of the Vedas. They have been taught every sound perfectly and they're able to start at any single point in a text and then recite it forward and backward. These students then become teachers who convey the Vedas to the next generation. Even today, families proudly bear the names of their ancestors' achievements. For example, Dwivedi, meaning master of the two Vedic collections. Trivedi, master of three, or Chaturvedi, master of all four Vedic collections. These feats of dedication are a remarkable tribute to the human capacity. Further, today many Hindus believe passionately that they are the people of India, divinely endowed with that land. Likewise, they believe the Vedas have eternally been Indian and have preserved knowledge of an ancient ideal civilization with a morality, technology, and other achievements that far surpassed any other culture, and even surpassed those of the 21st century. Today, Hindus compose more than 80% of the people of the Republic of India. The political party currently in office represents a movement dedicated to Hindutva, or Hindu-ness, as the essence of the Indian nation. These Vedas, from the emic perspective, are thus eternally beyond human historical time. Scholars from the outside of the Hindu tradition, and also many within it, however, often adopt an Edic perspective. This locates the Vedas as part of human history, as the product of people. The Vedas evolved over hundreds of years as the communities that continued to create them changed within earthly time and in interaction with other communities and cultures. As such, each of the chronological series of Vedic texts can tell historians much about the experiences, values, and lifestyles of the people who created them at that historical moment. Edic linguists calculate the speed with which the language of the Vedas, like other languages, evolved. So such scholars can give a rough date to each Vedic poem and put each into its historical sequence. Other scholars plot geographically the regions and animals mentioned in each Vedic text. Most Edic scholars assert that the earliest of these Vedas date back to around 1500 BCE. While some Vedic texts continued to be composed over the following 10-century-long period. During that time, the Vedic peoples gradually migrated from Central and West Asia into North India and then began to settle there. Hence, a close reading and analysis of the literal meaning of the words of each Vedic text provides an unmatched source for ancient human history. This textual evidence can be supplemented by genetic and other Edic evidence about the Vedic people and their history of interactions with the Adivasi and Indus cultures and communities that were already present in India. These two different perspectives, emic and Edic, sometimes lead to contrasting understandings of the Vedas, and we should keep both in mind. Within the Vedas as a whole, there are four major collections. The first of these is the Rig Veda. Because of the sacred power of the Rig Veda, and also because it contains the most information about human history, this Vedic collection usually receives the most attention from both emic and Edic perspectives. The Rig Veda contains 1,028 poetic hymns, totaling 10,600 verses. Each poem addresses and praises one or more divine beings. They're arranged into 10 books, with the middle six known as the family books, since each was preserved by a particular clan. For Edic scholars, these six appear to be the oldest, since their language is the earliest and the lifestyle they describe is that of related clans migrating into northwestern India. Later books, composed around 1000 BCE, according to Edic scholars, are the products of Vedic clans as they settled in North India and traded, contended, and mixed with the other communities already living there. In addition to the Rig Veda, there are other Vedic collections that highlight the rituals of sacrifice to divine beings, provide the rhythmic models for the recitation of hymns, and contained charms, spells, and medical guidance. Along with other later parts of the Shruti, there are the Brahmanas, or detailed guidebooks for how to properly perform the elaborate Vedic rituals, or to teach other bodies of knowledge, including mathematics or astronomy. According to Edic scholars, these seem to date from the period roughly 1200 to 600 BCE, overlapping but generally later than the Rig Veda. Then, dating from 900 to 500 BCE, there are the Aranyakas and Upanishads, which are more philosophical texts concerning the largest issues about the nature of existence, including the universe and all of its components. Edic scholars also locate these texts and the communities that created them over time in a larger human history as Vedic society developed in complexity and sophistication. Shruti uses an ancient language known as Vedic Sanskrit. Since the 18th century, Edic linguists have identified Vedic Sanskrit as the oldest surviving language within the Indo-European language family. By tracing back from Vedic Sanskrit and other early languages in this large language family, scholars have found that the root form of Indo-European language most likely originated somewhere in West Central Asia, and then spread outward through migrations and also cultural influences in each direction across Asia and into Europe. Most of the current languages of Europe, including English, also descended from this language family, with only today's Basque, Hungarian, Finnish, and Estonian coming from other language families unrelated to Indo-European. The people in Iran speak Persian, which is also descended from the Indo-European mother tongue and is relatively close in its earliest form to Vedic Sanskrit. In this way, we can trace the cultural origin of Vedic Sanskrit and its branch of peoples and reconstruct how they spread out into India from the northwest roughly around 1500 BCE. For about 500 years, as various groups of Vedic language speakers migrated into India, they continued to compose and recite the poems of the Rig Veda. Edic scholars have studied the developing form of Sanskrit, as well as the new places and things described in the Rig Veda, to try to date the composition of each poem. Other Indo-European languages, for example, do not use certain sounds like retroflexes, which are part of Vedic Sanskrit and are also present in most other Indian languages. This suggests that some Vedic Sanskrit words developed after extensive contact with people already in India, or when mention of a land of many rivers first appears. This may mean that the hymn was composed as this clan emerged from the mountains into the many-rivered region called Punjab, which literally means the land of five rivers, and is today half in India and half in Pakistan. When a Rig Vedic hymn describes dolphins or hundred-oared ships, this may indicate that it was composed when this clan encountered the wide Indus River or reached the shore of the Indian Ocean, both of which contained dolphins and evidently already had large ships plying their waters. Some of the later poems in the Rig Veda mention elephants, monkeys, hyenas, and other Indian animals. When analyzed chronologically using Edic tools, the Vedic texts also include much detailed information about the clans that compose them, as well as the other communities and cultures that they encountered. By looking closely at how the composers of the Vedic poems describe themselves, we can reconstruct their ways of life and beliefs. The early Vedic poems largely describe herding clans called Jana. Because these clans migrated, they left no archaeological evidence of temples or other buildings. They also cremated their dead, so there are no graves containing skeletons that would provide more information about them. The early Vedic hymns, however, suggest that, like tribes everywhere, these clans did not have much internal social differentiation, except that elders were honored and men and women tended to contribute in different ways to the community. Clearly, some members of some clans devoted themselves to reciting devotional hymns in order to obtain the favor and gifts of the Vedic gods. These Rig Vedic deities each embodied a force like the sun, darkness, rainstorms with lightning and thunder, fertility, the bull or fire. By addressing a particular god or goddess, the poet made sure that the praising poem reached the specific appropriate divinity. Then the Vedic poet praised that deity, attributing to him or her vast, even transcendent power. Most Vedic hymns also established a personal relationship between the poet's clan and that deity, especially as a father or mother, who therefore had a duty to protect the clan as the child. Finally, most Vedic poems end with a request, like the defeat of enemies, sunlight, protection from darkness, rain, fertility of the clan's livestock and its married couples, the strength of a bull, or the transforming power of fire, which can turn raw things into cooked ones, both food and also dead bodies. As the power of these Vedic hymns grew, since they apparently produced the desired result, the reciting poets preserved them and passed them on to students. The early Rig Veda thus seems to show the specialization of some men or families as priests with expertise in rituals. The Vedic deity Varuna was an early model of the moral and religious teacher and leader among the gods, and perhaps also a model for these emerging human priests as well. Other poems show how these migrating Vedic clans traveled by wagons and carts, sometimes drawn by oxen. They did have some gold, but it was one of the few measures of wealth other than knowledge of the Vedic poems themselves and the clan's livestock. They evidently had goats, donkeys, and dogs, some trained to hunt boar, but cattle were especially highly valued. Cow's milk was evidently savored, including in a heated drink, so the Vedic people were evidently not lactose intolerant, as were some other Asians. The essence of milk, clarified butter called ghee, was worthy of offering to the gods. Cows themselves were dedicated as the very highest of sacrifices. The Vedic cultures had also mastered horses. They seem to have used these horses to pull three-wheeled chariots, especially when charging into battle. The Vedas describe halters and harnesses for these chariot horses, but not horseshoes or stirrups or saddles, so they may not as often had ridden on horseback. The charioteers and other warriors had quivers full of feathered arrows with bone or bronze metal heads, sometimes poison-covered, shot from powerful bows. Archers wore four-armed gauntlets to protect them from harm from their own bowstrings. Many fighters wore inner and outer armor that the hymns praise as impierceable. Some Vedic clans and individuals seem to have specialized in protecting the clan and in capturing the cattle and resources of others. The model of human warriors was the fierce, black-bearded god Indra, the martial leader of all Vedic divinities. Many of the hymns of the Rig Veda praise Indra as invincible in battle, wielding lightning bolts in the form of a bronze mace. In this, he appears to hold the same position in the Vedas that comparable Indo-European warrior deities did, Zeus for the ancient Greeks and Thor for the ancient Scandinavian. Since all three of these cultures came from the same Indo-European source, this makes sense. The authors of some Rig Vedic hymns call upon Indra to guide them in victory against other clans of Arya, meaning the noble people, which is how the Vedic clans often refer to themselves. This suggests intra and inter-clan conflicts, not unusual among people anywhere in the world. The Rig Veda also describes Indra as the war leader of a group of gods called the Deva, the Shining Ones. This Indo-European term also appears for God in the Greek theos and Latin deus. In the early Rig Vedic hymns, another group of divinities were the Asura, sometimes described as relatives of the Deva, evidently their elder brothers or even father. But in the later Rig Vedic hymns, the Asura become enemies of the Deva. As so often happens, when relatives fight, it can produce the most violent conflicts. So the asuras eventually became evil demons whom Indra strips of their powers and supporters and then defeats. Significantly, this apparently shows us the growing human conflict between Indo-European clans that migrated into India and those clans that migrated into Iran. As the Zoroastrian religion developed in Iran, its divinities were called Ahura, while the demons were called Deva. Thus, these two cultures separated and conflicted, and so did their religious traditions. Vedic gods, Devas, became Iranian demons, and Iranian gods became Vedic demons, Asuras. As one Vedic hymn states, from the high plain they went apart in opposite directions. Until the mid-20th century, some historians thought that the Vedic people had invaded and conquered the Indus cities, since there is some mention in the Rig Veda of destroying cities and fortresses. But that theory has now been largely discredited, since there's no archaeological evidence to support it. The ruins of the Indus cities do not show any indication of having been destroyed by invaders. There are no piles of corpses in the streets. Instead, most of the people of the Indus seem to have gradually dispersed across all of India, at least 400 years before the Vedic clans arrived. Further, the Vedic clans seem to have migrated into India through an incremental process, not an invading wave. As the various Vedic clans settled, especially in parts of North India, they competed, cooperated, traded, and mixed with the communities and cultures already there. But many poems call upon Indra to defeat other demons, especially their leader Ritra, the shoulderless serpent or son of a spider. When Indra defeats Ritra, Indra frees for his own people the rivers, cows, forests, and mountains that Ritra had hidden away for his followers, known as the Dasa and the Parni. These superhuman conflicts should probably represent, in Edic terms, a reflection of the history of the Vedic clans as they migrated into India and encountered, respectively, the remnants of the Indus and also the Adivasi cultures and communities. The Dasa may be the settled farmers, cultural descendants of the dispersed Indus civilization. Often in human world history, there are conflicts between settled farmers and nomadic herders over resources. Thus, to the Vedic clans, Indra was liberating the water and land from Ritra's Dasa followers who had barred their herds from them. Perhaps Dasa communities regarded the Vedic herders as the encroaching ones on their irrigation systems and fields of crops. This may be the classic free-range cattlemen against the sod-busting farmers. Eventually, the Vedic culture seems to have dominated. The word Dasa eventually comes to mean slave, but not in the sense of dehumanizing race-based chattel slavery as practiced, for example, in the Americas. Rather, one can proudly be a slave or devotee of a god, as in Indradasa, slave or devotee of Indra, a Hindu name used widely today. The Parni appear in the later Vedic hymns as groups that emerge from forest to raid and carry off cattle. So these may be the Vedic name for Adivasi groups that they encountered. Again, we don't have surviving evidence from the Adivasi perspective, but the long history of these communities often involved raiding as well as trading with outsiders. The later Vedic poems also indicate, as it settled and developed trade, that society was becoming more complex. The later Rigvedic poems describe peaceful villages surrounded by fields, soothed by the lowing of well-fed, domesticated cattle. Some people seem to have been drawn to particular specialist occupations, but these do not yet seem to have been hereditary. For example, one Vedic poet describes his father as a physician and his mother as a miller, although these may be metaphors rather than direct representations of society. The Vedas also provide us with glimpses of everyday life. Some Vedic poems mention musical instruments, including flutes, lutes, harps, and drums. One poem is an evocative lament by a man addicted to gambling with dice. These dice are, quote, hooking, goading, debasing, scorching. He bemoans, when I resolve, I will not play. I am bereft of my companions who go off without me. But when he gives in to his addiction, puffing himself with I will win, the dice run counter to his desire, conferring winning throws on his opponent. As a result of his endless losses, my wife pushes me away. Father, mother, brothers disown me, saying, we don't know him. Lead him away bound. In the end, the gambler, in distress, finds no one to pity him. In several hymns, a woman laments being a co-wife, living in rivalry with other wives and striving to hold the affections of their shared husband. One poem, put in the mouth of Indra's wife Indrani, describes a powerful herb that enables her to, quote, blow away my co-wife, making my husband my own. A subsequent poem celebrates a wife's triumph, quote, I, a cunning woman, now have gained victory over my husband. I am the beacon, I am the head. Only my will should my husband follow. Other poems seek divine intervention to ensure successful conception of a son, or to provide protection against miscarriages or the dangers of childbirth. Ideas that emerged that would remain strong currents in later Indian society. Generally, women seem to have been able to marry into a higher social class, a process known to Edic anthropologists as hypergamy. In Vedic poems, when mortal women married divine males, these hypergamous marriages customarily succeeded. But when goddesses and other divine females married mortal men, the wife often became dissatisfied and left her human husband behind. These may be symbolic statements of how Vedic society functioned as well. In addition to such evidence about personal relationships, the Vedas can also tell us much about the larger history of the clans associated with them. By analyzing the structure of an important Vedic Kshauta, or higher sacrifice, we can find evidence about how the Vedic people represented their broad migrations. In such rituals, many different priestly specialists participated, conducted by a leading priest called the Brahmin. There were four altars made of clay. In the west is the home altar, made circular to represent the earth. This was where the ritual specialist guided the sacrificer to kindle his household fire. Then, the fire ritually moved eastward, first to the site where divinities are called down to be fed pure substances like ghee and soma, an intoxicating juice pressed from a plant. To the south was a semicircular altar representing the atmosphere, which protects against demonic forces. Finally, the fire moved fully eastward to a square altar representing the sky. We can perhaps see in this movement of the ritual fire the migration into North India of the Vedic clans themselves, from west moving to the east, with danger coming from the south. But these later Vedic rituals required the construction of mathematically complex clay brick foundations, typically in the form of a vast bird. This bird would ritually convey the sacrifice and the sacrificer to heaven. But the Vedic clans did not have their own developed tradition of geometry or expertise in building out of bricks. The Indus civilization, however, did. So these altars and the structure of the vast bird may be evidence of how the Vedic tradition absorbed the knowledge and skills of the remnants of the Indus culture. Also, genetic evidence indicates there was intermarriage among these communities. What emerges across North India, therefore, is a composite culture, although Sanskrit and Sanskrit-derived languages tended to dominate there. Both the linguistic and genetic evidence indicates that the main settlement area of the Vedic communities was across North India, especially in the Ganges Plain. Over the centuries, they settled in different ecological niches and developed their own distinct cultures, including cuisine, based on the local crops and language. The major languages in North India are all daughter cultures of Sanskrit, but the people who speak these distinct regionally based languages and their thousands of local dialects seem to be mostly biological descendants of all three sources, Vedic, Indus, and Adivasi. In contrast, the four major languages of South India are not part of the Indo-European language family and are thus not derived from Sanskrit. This suggests that the descendants of Veda communities did not migrate as much into that region. And those that did either remained a small but distinctive minority, often preserving Sanskrit, or else merged into the local communities, which may be more heavily descended from the people who left the Indus region as that civilization declined. Along with the shrinking Adivasi languages, this process produced the current map of Indian languages. In the next lecture, we'll continue to follow the later social and cultural developments as the Vedic culture and the earlier settlers of India interacted to produce so-called caste systems.